Welcome to Perspectives from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. This program, using the Zoom platform, pre-recorded on Tuesday, April 13th for playback on Thursday, April 15th. And the show will be aired on WFSU-FM and also will be archived on WFSU.org. And if you slip over to our public media Facebook page, you may find a couple little excerpts from the program floating around on there too. You know, Florida does so well in a lot of categories when it comes to quality of life issues, but the state also lags much of the nation when it comes to the status of just too many children. There are lots of organizations, certainly both public and private, that strive to serve these children, and we can tick them off. You've got, you know, of course, the Florida Department of Children and Families. You have the Guardian Ad Litem program. You have organizations like we have in this region of the Florida Panhandle, Holt Child Leon. We have the newly created Children's Services Council, of which there are several others across Florida, a plethora of organizations that focus on kids. But today we thought we'd delve into the Florida Network of Children's Advocacy Centers, and that's the statewide membership organization that represents all local children's advocacy centers in the state of Florida. It's an accredited state chapter of the National Children's Alliance, and it's a not-for-profit 501c3 organization founded in 1996 by a membership of six local centers, and that membership has grown exponentially since, as it now embodies all 27 children's advocacy centers in Florida and serves 85% of the children and families in the Sunshine State. A gigantic services footprint for sure. So we're going to talk about the organization, how it interfaces with others, both public and private, and just talk kids for about an hour, if that's okay with you. And we're so happy that you could be joining the conversation here, listening in on it. So to talk about the network and how it helps kids, we have the executive director, Cindy Vallely. And Cindy, it is so good for you to join us, and thank you for coming on board for this Perspectives.
Thank you so much for having us. We're excited to talk about children's advocacy centers and the work that they do for the children and families in Florida.
And that is all parts of Florida, which includes Collier County, and that is where Jackie Stevens is hanging out. She is board president of the network. Hi, Jackie. How's the weather down in your neck of Naples right now?
It is beautiful out right now, so, and thank you for having us.
Well, thank you for coming on. Back to Cindy as exec thumbnail. I gave a little introduction as to what the network is and how it has evolved since its founding in 96, Cindy, but talk about what exactly do you guys do? What is the purpose of the network?
The purpose of the network is we are the state chapter for Florida. So every state has a state chapter, and as you previously mentioned, we are accredited by the National Children's Alliance, and we just went through our reaccreditation and received that again in January. So that is an accreditation that is good for 5 years. So we have to meet certain standards, and then the child advocacy centers in Florida and all the states have to meet certain standards to be accredited centers as well. So as the state chapter, and if you look across the country, you see chapters that are very different in size and scope of the work that they do. We are fortunate. We have grown. I've been the executive director for 4 years now. We grew from three full-time staff to six. So we are a busy staff. We have a statewide training coordinator. We have a statewide strategic planner and data person. We have a finance director and admin support as well. So as the state chapter, we provide technical assistance to the 27 child advocacy centers that are already in Florida. We will also provide technical assistance to communities who may not have a child advocacy center that are interested in starting one. We are pass-through funders, so we receive funds from the state legislature that come through the state chapter, and there's a formula, funding formula. We also have our Stop Child Abuse license plate that generates funds for us at the chapter and also the children's advocacy centers locally. And we also receive funding from the National Children's Alliance. And so with that, we coordinate statewide projects. So we're quite busy at the chapter. And then annually, we put on the Crimes Against Kids Conference in Orlando. Last year, we were the first state chapter to go 100% virtual with our conference, with all 56 presentations over 2 days were live. It was so successful that we had 5 other states and the National Children's Alliance reach out to us and say, how did you do that? So we were very excited. And this year we will be bringing our conference as a hybrid. So we will have some people in person and some will participate virtually. And then, like I said, we provide a lot of technical assistance. If there's chapters that, if there's CACs in the state that might need help with their reaccreditation or becoming accredited, we just provide different level of technical assistance.
Well, let's talk where the rubber meets the road then. Jackie Stephens, let me throw this on to you in Collier County. Talk about the typical kids, if there are such, that the Children's Advocacy Center in your area provides. What kind of services and what kind of kids do you serve?
Well, we serve a variety of different children who are victims of child abuse and neglect. Probably about 30 to 40% of the kids that we work with are victims of sexual abuse. We also work with children who are physically abused, medical neglect, severe neglect. So there's a wide variety. Each of our centers is a little bit different and a little bit unique. We also have a domestic violence program as well, so that we provide some case management and services for children who've been involved in, you know, where there's been family violence and domestic violence. So that may be a little unique, but, and I think with Children's Advocacy Centers, the important thing is that there are a wide variety of agencies that are involved in the investigation of abuse. And we all kind of have slightly different perspectives and roles, but we do all have the same core vision and mission of making sure our child is protected and safe. And that's what we really want. That's what we care about. So our Children's Advocacy Centers throughout Florida, what we do is we help to coordinate that intervention, the investigation, you know, from the initial onset of the report of suspected abuse to really to the final disposition when it may go to a criminal trial, which could be years after the first report comes in. So, you know, we work very closely with our Department of Children and Families, with our child protection teams here in Florida, and the child protection teams will provide the medical evaluation, forensic interviews, and a few other services as well. And also law enforcement, our state attorney's office, and our mental health. And then we also have advocates that are a real strong part of what we're doing.
We heard anecdotally, and hard data is tough to come by now because they're still being compiled and there are a lot of obstacles to obtaining good contemporaneous information right now. But ever since the pandemic hit, what we have been hearing is that a lot of child abuse and dysfunctional family dynamics have essentially gone underground. And it has been very difficult to find the children who have been abused because they haven't gone to school. They right. don't have the connections that they did before, person to person. And so, some people are saying, oh, my gosh, look, child abuse numbers are way down. We're not seeing it being reported. But that doesn't mean it has gone right. away. What do you guys see?
Well, you're correct in what you're saying. And actually, a couple months ago, I pulled some of the data from last year to this year for the first 6 months of the year, and basically when the pandemic did begin, and I compared it to last year. And statewide, hotline reports were down about 30%, and our agency also saw that. So we were down about 30% as well, which I know that all of our clinicians, we were all very worried about that because, you know, child abuse did not just magically go away when COVID came around. I mean, that did not happen. So we were worried about kids that were, you know, basically they were isolated and not visible in the community. And, those things were very concerning. And I know that I was in a meeting recently where we were looking at drownings and near drownings of children, and those numbers, and I don't remember the exact number, but it was significantly higher this year than it has been in the last few years. And I think probably a lot of that had to do with lack of supervision, you know, people working out of their homes, kids at home, not in school. And it was just really hard to provide that supervision. So there was a whole gamut of things that we're concerned about. We are seeing that kind of change now. We're seeing our referrals have really gone up almost more now than it was before the pandemic. So, you know, that's significant as well. So we are seeing, you know, a continuing increase now.
Yeah, a strange.
And I think another, excuse me, Tom, if I could just build on what Jackie said, when everyone went into lockdown and we were seeing a reduction in numbers, what the child advocacy centers and child protection teams were seeing was the cases that were coming to them were more acute. The abuse was more acute. And like Jackie said, we know child abuse just didn't go away. But unfortunately, when children aren't in school or aren't participating in after school activities, we don't have those eyes on them like we would pre-pandemic.
And when you have those kind of cases and it advances through DCF and you maybe even have to call in law enforcement, the state attorney of the circuit or whatever to intervene there, the courts still haven't gotten back up to speed yet. So it seems like the entire mechanism, if not totally gummed up, has certainly been slowed to a near crawl because of what we've been through in the past year.
Yes, the courts, that has been slowed, you know, and slowed down. And so, you know, that's starting to open up again, but that did put a lot of delay in some of these cases that we see, particularly like with criminal prosecution and that type of situation. And some of those cases, you know, when we don't have COVID, you know, can take 2-3 years to get through the system. And so, you know, we are going to see some delays with, you know, the prosecution rates, I guess, but or at least the ability to get into the, you know, the actual trial. And so.
Well, and that gets us also into things like parent fostering for kids from dysfunctional families. If the determination comes down from DCF that, you know, we can't keep this family together, the kids have to go somewhere for their own safety and well-being, at least in the short term. And yet we keep hearing stories about, you know, some folks who are in this business are perhaps not the best equipped to handle foster kids. What does the network do to try to mitigate that situation? Cindy, what do you guys advance as far as helping out?
We don't do a lot within the foster care system. That falls to the community-based care agencies when the Department of Children and Families privatized the foster care system. If a child were in a foster home and they made the allegation of physical or sexual abuse or there was neglect, they would still be referred to their child advocacy center and child protection team in Florida. So in that perspective, the local CAC would be involved, but that falls really more to the community-based care agencies.
Okay. Go ahead, Jackie, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I could add to that in that really what we're doing too is we're in that very initial stage of the investigation. So we're part of the first response. When a report comes into the Florida hotline or to law enforcement, our child protection teams, you know, we're doing those forensic interviews, we're doing the forensic medical evaluations, we're trying to determine has abuse occurred, has it not occurred, and then what do we need to do to make sure that the child is safe today? And what do we do to make sure the child's safe in the long term? So, you know, and that's when our advocates will work with families to help try and find, you know, link them with other resources in the community and really try and help families. Because a lot of these families, you know, you can, with the appropriate intervention, help them out. And the kids don't all have to go to foster care. You know, sometimes people feel like every one of them is going to go, and that's not the case. And so, you know, and then we're also providing therapy and mental health counseling. And so in that way, we help to mitigate kids having to be placed in foster care, because that's just another trauma on top of the other traumas that the kids have been through. But, you know, so we are going to play a key role in helping to determine if that child's going to be safe in the home or not. So,
yeah. And just coming off of what we'll, Timing is everything. We'll remind folks we're just coming off of Children's Week here in Florida, which was also a different kind of celebration. We also noticed that there are little hands that are a part of the logo here for the network of children's advocacy centers as well. And this particular year, again, because of COVID, the traditional hanging of the little hands in the plaza level of the Florida Capitol was moved right down the street, and the hands were hung in the Tallahassee Community College Center downtown. But that does not mean that we're not thinking of the kids. And what is the legislature thinking in terms of kids during this session? Cindy, you want to give us an update on what kind of bills are moving through that impact children and families?
I know right now our funding is looking pretty good, so we're very excited about that, that we're not going to be, hopefully when the session is over, we will not be losing any of our funding to the advocacy centers. So that's very important to the centers. As far as other bills, I really couldn't address some of the other bills. Jackie, do you have any?
Not a lot. I know there are some other bills that are going through about kids being properly restrained in automobiles and seat belts and things like that too, which I think, you know, I'm not sure where that is at the moment, but I know we're looking at that too.
Yeah, still there seems to be a rising evolutionary, I guess, attitudinal change in the legislature when it comes to children's issues, that I can recall when such things, yeah, it's really important, and it kind of get blown off by the end of session. Right. There seems to be a higher awareness level right now anyway, and to use the old Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. And that's seems to be where the legislature is right now too. But what more, without lobbying here, what more do you think could be done? Because there are a lot of indices where Florida is not doing really super well when it comes to child welfare, and you guys see it every day. So besides throwing money at the problem, what else do we have to do, do you think?
Cindy, what do you...
It really starts with the hotline when calls go in, and it's also getting the awareness out about child advocacy centers and what they provide. And Jackie and I were talking about this the other day, that just the name Child Advocacy Center can be a misnomer. And some of the calls that we get at the office where people think that we will help advocate for school issues, and that's not really what we do. The work that the Child Advocacy Centers do across the country is primarily focused on children who have alleged sexual abuse or physical abuse or neglect, and there's the core services that are provided to them. So it's just really getting the word out. I think if you were to ask your neighbor who is not involved with criminal justice system or has no knowledge of child advocacy centers or child protection, you know, where would you take your child if they said someone inappropriately touched them? And I would imagine the majority of people would not even say to the local child advocacy center. So it's really getting the word out as to the work. The Florida Network is 25 years old this year, and frankly, I don't think we've done such a great job in really getting the word out about the Florida Network and what the child advocacy centers do in Florida. Florida is also very unique in that we have child protection teams also. And so to be a child advocacy center in the state of Florida, you also have to be a child protection team, where you have to have a working agreement with the child protection team. And as Jackie had mentioned, they are the medically driven component of the work of child advocacy centers, and they are managed by the Department of Health, Children's Medical Services. So we work closely with DOH, Children's Medical Services. What else can I say about that? I think the largest benefits about Florida having child protection teams, and like I said, we're the only state in the country that has them, is that we have more pediatric experts that are pediatric child abuse experts than we hear from my colleagues in other states, where they're lucky if they have one or two physicians that's an expert in child abuse. And so we feel very fortunate in Florida that we have the child protection teams, that we have that expertise, that our medical track in our conference every year. We have no problem getting physicians to come in and present in the medical track because we are very fortunate, like I said, in Florida, that we have that component. So that's a little different than other states, but we are fortunate, and we're fortunate that we have a great working relationship with Department of Health. We're working closely right now with Department of Children and Families, trying to help with a redesign of the training for child protective investigators. That is a tough, tough job. And to walk into someone's home following the abuse, the hotline call, these investigators walk into just so many different scenarios. And so what we're trying to do is help with the redesign of the training for child protective investigators to get them more prepared. So we feel like our real state partners are Department of Health, Department of Children and Families. And we also have to thank the Attorney General's Office for the Victims of Crime Act VOCA grant funding that they provide to the child advocacy centers in Florida, as well as other agencies. So I feel like we have some really good state partners. We've partnered with Ounce of Prevention. We all have our pinwheels out for April for Child Abuse Prevention Month. So that's what we are working on right now as we continue to build those partnerships at the state level. And I think you can resolve so many issues when you can just sit down with your partners and you have a good respect for the other agencies that are coming to the table to all try to help resolve, educate, and advocate on behalf of the children.
I'm glad you brought about Ounce of Prevention because a friend of mine just asked me the other day as we were driving by at DCF headquarters, as a matter of fact, on Blairstone Road. They said, "What's with all the pinwheels?" And I said, "Well, that's," and it's a terrific awareness situation.
Well, let me tell you, right? Yeah.
But Jackie, that was a great overview, yeah. Cindy. But let's just say, Jackie, a call comes into the child abuse hotline. What happens next? Even though no situation is typical, but just walk us through what occurs when that happens.
So a call will come into the hotline, and it will be dispatched to the local area where the child lives, where the abuse occurred. A Department of Children and Families will receive that, and they'll contact law enforcement. And then simultaneously, that report will be reviewed by our child protection team program. So in Florida, there are certain cases that are mandatory for the Department of Children and Families to refer to the child protection team, particularly on younger children with, you know, physical abuse, bruises or bruises to the face or head or neck, and also sexual abuse cases. So there are certain things by Florida statute that are supposed to be or mandated to be referred to child protection teams. So that will be, all of that will all happen kind of the same time. Department of Children and Families will make, if it's an appropriate type of case to be seen for our child protection team and our CAC, will make that referral to us, and our CAC and our child protection teams, everybody basically comes to the Children's Advocacy Center. So what law enforcement, Department of Children and Families, they will bring the child, the non-offending caregivers, and we will then start that initial assessment and evaluation of abuse. And so by doing this eliminates children having to go to the police department to give a statement or to a DCF office to give a statement and then going to a hospital for a medical exam. So everything can happen in one location. And so everybody will respond to a CAC. So, and then the Children's Advocacy Centers are basically designed to be child friendly and supportive and warm and multicultural and so that child, whether it's a 14-year-old boy or a 5-year-old little girl, you know, that they feel comfortable in that environment. And so that helps to reduce any further trauma that an investigation might add on top of the trauma that this child may have already experienced. So at that point, we work as a team to evaluate and, to figure out and to communicate about, you know, what has happened and what is going on in that child's life, and then to put the appropriate interventions in place to make sure that child's, cared for and safe. So, you know, we work with a multidisciplinary team. So that's going to be law enforcement, Department of Children and Families, mental health advocacy, our medical component, child protection teams. And really, we it really facilitates communication amongst these partners. And really, we learn from one another. I mean, when Cindy was talking a little earlier about, you know, what CACs do and our partners in the community, partners around the state, it really, we learn a great deal from each other. And by learning, we can better assess and provide the services to kids that we need to provide. So.
Yeah, a truly holistic approach there, and with the emphasis on trying to keep the response level low key for the benefit of the kids, because that, even for grownups, that can be a horribly traumatic experience, and for the little ones, it's just beyond terrifying. So if you're just joining us, thank you. We appreciate that. And if you miss all or part of a Perspectives program on WFSU Public Media, it is available on our handy-dandy website, WFSU.org. We try to have the most recent program up within the proverbial two shakes of the lamb's tail, although it's usually 24 hours after the program actually airs on the radio. Speaking about the network of children's advocacy centers throughout Florida, with Board President Jackie Stevens and Executive Director Cindy Ballardly, we have done a series of programs here on Florida Public Radio about the proliferation of Baker Act of when it comes to children's situations, which at first we thought, well, how extensive could it be? And it turned out to be almost a default position in some circumstances. Cindy, your thoughts on that? Is that do you think a terrible thing? And how do we maybe ramp that down a little bit with more education, whatever?
I do know certain law enforcement agencies have CIT officers, and they've been trained in responding to people, whether they're adults or children, who might be displaying some kind of mental illness or a mental strain. I really believe it starts with the education. We've got our first responders. The more they could be educated in how to approach or diffuse a situation. And I understand it's easy to sit back here and say it when we're not the one on, you know, on the scene or responding. I have read some of those articles that the number of children being Baker Acted, that is a concern. But again, I do think it starts with education to the first responders and to teachers. I mean, there's so much that goes. Our teachers are just bombarded with so much that they are mandated reporters for child abuse. As you know, in the schools, they deal with all sorts of situations. And just to educate them on how to approach a child who may be experiencing or displaying some kind of mental health issue is the first thing. So law enforcement and teachers, I think, are the key. And again, they have so much that they're responsible for as it is, you know, to put one more thing on them, but they are the ones who would really see the children first.
Yeah. And it's, go ahead, Jackie.
I was good. If I could add to that. Yes, it's, I agree with what Cindy's saying. I mean, it really does come down to a lot of training with the first responders and how they react or respond to a child, you know, or an adult or a child who may be suicidal. I think it's very difficult to when you actually see this happen with children. And occasionally we may have a child who's Baker acted from our CACs. And it's, you know, it's very heartbreaking to see a 12-year-old little girl who's a sexual abuse victim be put in handcuffs in the back of a patrol car. You know, that's heartbreaking because there should be a better way to do that, you know. But, you know, it's, again, it's easy for us to sit here and say that when we're not the first responders who a child or, you know, could potentially harm themselves or harm somebody else. And so it can be for the law enforcement officer's safety as well, but it is heartbreaking. I think we really have to look at that as a, you know, statewide and how these things have, particularly for children who are Baker acted and how we respond to these kids. It is one of the things that we do at our center is we do trauma screenings when children come into the center. And, you know, the particular screening tool that we use does ask about suicidal ideation. And so if somebody scores high on that, we're going to do further evaluation and further screening. And then we have a psychologist on staff that will, you know, in our mental health program that can further assess. And then, you know, occasionally maybe 1 to 3 times a year, we have to have a Baker Act from our facility. But, you know, we have differences with how who the police officer is that may respond. And I think a lot of it does go down to training, and, you know, so it's, but it is something I think we should really pay attention to.
Yeah. And even as we see what's going on with the trial of the officer in Minneapolis, there seems to be a growing recognition that perhaps more law enforcement agencies should have additional resources when it comes to dealing with mental health crisis situations for adults and certainly for kids. So that right. That old saw that, you know, when all you got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. For law enforcement, they have a long list of priorities that they feel that they have to maintain when it comes to dealing with these circumstances, but that may not be the right methodology in all cases. So is that something else that would be helpful if we had more agencies that had that kind of a resource available? So when it obviously was not a violent felony, this individual would be able to interface with the case and perhaps with you guys as well, that no, we don't take the child to juvenile detention. We take them to the child advocacy center. That's one of the cases that should be more appropriately put there.
Well, it would be more appropriate if there is a Baker Act like that they would go to whatever the local mental health agency is, you know, for inpatient treatment and screening and evaluation. So, you know, we have circumstances where occasionally because a child is being investigated because of possible abuse, you know, that they may have a lot of depression or feel really bad, and kids can be impulsive. And so we have to, you know, we have to be concerned about that. And so they wouldn't bring them to us, and, you know, because of the mental health piece, as far as Baker acting or suicidal ideation, that would be best addressed by, you know, a local community mental health provider. But, you know, I think what I guess I'm talking about is that actual when you have to transport that child to that facility, and that you need to have, you know, tender loving care and you know, be gentle with this, with these kids, you know, because they've already been hurt, and we don't want to make it worse. That also said, most of our law enforcement officers who, you know, are very appropriate, and they very much care about the well-being of kids, and, you know, a lot of them parents too, and they, you know, so there's a lot of empathy and concern, so.
Well, a lot of agencies, too. We mentioned at the outset that we have now, 9, I think, Children's Services Council scattered around Florida. Cindy, do you folks work with them? And how do you avoid duplication when it comes to this plethora of organizations providing children's-oriented services out there?
It's interesting because it just came up. We are working with an agency that wants to be the CAC in Treasure Coast, and they've come a long way, and they actually reached out to their Children's Services Council. So it's very timely. I just sent an email to all of the CACs in Florida this morning and said, tell me who's working with your local Children's Services Council. So we have different levels. I know our CAC in Pensacola just recently helped get that one passed. I know we just had the one here in Leon County. So we are seeing they do different type work. They focus more on early education than child abuse victims. But as we get more and more councils, as a matter of fact, I'm going to be emailing the president, the statewide president for the Children's Services Council this week and say, let me introduce who we are and what we do. I know the one agency in Treasure Coast has recently reached out to you. This is what I know. our CAC in Manatee County, they actually get some funding from their Children's Services Council. The same with our Child Advocacy Center in Gainesville. They receive a little bit of funding to do some training and to staff some of the more difficult cases where they're trying to help with placement of a child. So we're seeing different levels of involvement across the state. So that's something that I'll be reaching out to them just to see where we can partner. And if it's nothing more than educating each other on what the services councils do versus what child advocacy centers do, then I think it would be a nice statewide partnership.
Jackie, if we had better parents, you guys would be out of business. How do we make better parents?
Well, you know, parenting is not easy, you know, so, you know, to say the least, but we do parenting education for the general community. So people who just want to learn things and new techniques and so forth, you know, so there's a number of ways. And a lot of what we want to do though, with, through the Children's Advocacy Centers and Child Protection Teams is we want to stop that multi-generational cycle of abuse. So we want to get in, you know, and help that family and that child. So when that child grows up, that there's not that same situation, that abuse doesn't repeat itself. Because, you know, all too often, you know, we will have a family come into our office and they'll say, you know, I was abused too when I was a child, and now here my child is. And, you know, so that's, you know, that's heartbreaking too. And those, the families didn't, you know, want that to happen. You know, it's just, they don't necessarily have that, the skills or the experience or the, that, you know, that they had from in their own childhoods with their own families, you know. So I think by just providing that intervention, that you can help break, you know, stop that cycle and, you know, so that it doesn't continue.
Yeah. Given the fact that raising a child is the toughest job that any of us will ever have. And yet, you hate to say they let anybody do it, but it is true. And many of us, you know, even super well-educated people and very caring people may not have all the tools and the skills to do a good job.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Tom, that's really where we have a strong mental health component too. That's one of the standards that a child advocacy center must have, even if it's not one that they have in-house, that it's a local therapist that are providing evidence-based therapy to children and the families. And that is critical in breaking that cycle that Jackie just referenced, is really giving them the mental health support, the therapeutic support, and the tools in which to thrive as adults, as they grow into adults. So we are very fortunate that we have a strong mental health component to the Child Advocacy Center model.
You know, the changing of the future is a major part of the trajectory here. You're right, it is generational. And as we learn from our parents, there too will we respond when situations come our way. You know, how did dad, how did mom do it? And we model our behavior on theirs. So that's going to be a continuing emphasis then, Jackie. I hear you and Cindy saying on this.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
And one of the things we had done when the world seemed to shut down was our child advocacy centers were very successful in doing telemental health. And so if we found funding, we got extra laptops, whatever it was they needed. I know internet is an issue for some of the families. But the CACs worked really hard to do what they could to ensure that that mental health component continued. And we're going to continue to do both as we're opening up more and more. We're going to continue to do in-person services, and we're going to continue to do telemental health for those families that just would not be able to get to a CAC to receive that service.
And the ongoing reluctance that a lot of people still have, even at this point in time, to go out and seek in-person kind of services when it comes to that sort of thing. Well, let's talk again about one of the resources that you folks are so instrumental in providing, and that is the upcoming conference. So give us an overview, and who's going to be talking, and what are the topics that are going to be on the agenda for this?
I wish I had the agenda with me. We have an incredible, we do 7 tracks. We have a law enforcement track. So we do law enforcement, mental health, forensic interview, and multidisciplinary team. We have a medical component. We have a victim advocacy track. And what am I missing, Jackie?
Advocacy, mental
and
health.
And we do leadership as well.
Yeah.
So this year, our keynote speaker is Victor Veith from the Zero Abuse Project. In prior years, we've had Elizabeth Smart was our keynote speaker 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Last year, we actually had Kristen was one of the lead prosecutors in the Bill Cosby case. She was our keynote last year. We'd love to have her back when we can meet in person. Last year, our conference, as I had mentioned, we went 100% virtual. This year, we will do a hybrid. We are going to limit the number of on-site attendees. We're working very closely with the resort in Orlando. And like I said, we have a great medical track. One of our law enforcement presenters, he presented for us last year. He's with the FBI out of Quantico. He is on the agenda again this year. We just have some great presenters. We are hoping to get the conference website live, at least, if not by Friday, at least by early next week, where the agenda will be posted. People can see, what the topics are, who all is presenting. We have probably 4 or 5 different pediatricians that are experts in child abuse that will be presenting as well. So we're very excited about that. And I'm just excited to start seeing people again.
It would be new and different, that's for sure. What are the dates of the conference, Cindy?
The dates are July 21st through the 23rd. It is in Orlando. This year we're at the Wyndham Bonnet Creek. They are doing an incredible job to keep their people safe. We will have all of their safety protocols on our website as well. And if I could also mention, Tom, we had our first fundraiser, it was 2020, right before we went into lockdown, before anyone even knew COVID was coming. And we did it at the Capital City Country Club, and it's called Brunch Bags and Bingo. And it is brand new designer purses. So if you are fortunate to win a round of bingo, you get to pick from the designer purses. Louis Vuitton is the big prize giveaway. And what we're doing with the funds that we receive from all the proceeds from that event are going to room makeovers for children who have been physically or sexually abused in their rooms and just want a fresh start. So we are excited. We hope to have the first 2 room makeovers on the website within the next few weeks. So we're very excited about that. And we have partnered again with Capital City Country Club for our event October 16th.
Wonderful. Well, Jackie, you are in one of the seething hotbeds of new residents coming to Florida right now. I saw some of the Collier County figures not too terribly long ago.
Yes.
And even though COVID has caused a lot of people to forego travel, when it comes to relocation, that does not seem to be the case. And people are trying to snap up houses before they double or triple in price. We're having a real, and I'm sure you are down there in Naples too, a major shortage of housing right now, but still a lot of people moving in. That means that the resources, the financial support that Cindy was just talking about is going to become even more critical because you're going to have more cases to deal with as we go forward.
And that's very true. So as our state grows, our needs grow for taking care of children, whether it's, our child protection, children's advocacy centers, our school systems, we have to be able to provide, that infrastructure to support families and children. And because in the long run, that just makes a much better community and society. So.
And a lot of our child advocacy centers, like everyone, had to postpone their fundraisers and local fundraisers and community support is critical to the child advocacy centers and other, nonprofits and agencies working to serve families in their community. And so I'm glad to see that they are starting to open up a little more because we can't just survive off of. We're very grateful to the state legislature that they see the need to fund the child advocacy centers, but our centers need to, they're continuously raising more funds to continue and serve more and more children.
So the state's only providing just a fraction of what you really need to operate then.
Most definitely. I mean, both our child protection team programs, our children's advocacy centers, you know, we are really only partially funded by the state. And the Attorney General's office is very supportive of our agencies and our children's advocacy centers. But so our Attorney General's office is probably about a little 25 to 30% of our agency funding, and our department health funding is maybe only funds about not even quite half of the program that we have. So, you know, that has been difficult this year with, you know, having to get leave our special events behind and not be able to reschedule them and just be uncertain about when we're going to be able to do these things again. So, and that's one of the things that's difficult about child, you know, with child protection is, you know, making sure that we do have, you know, the adequate funding to provide the services that we need for kids.
Yeah, when you say public-private partnership, it sounds so lovely until you realize that, right. that the money aspect of that is heartrending at best. But getting back into a posture where you can continue to re-amp up these sorts of things is certainly going to help. Oh, folks, we could talk about this for forever, but we've only got about 5 minutes remaining in the program. So why don't we take the last part of our perspectives here to talk a little blue sky here, getting even beyond the day-to-day fundraising problems that we all have, and just what you would like to see happen as executive director then, Cindy Vallely. How do you see the network of child advocacy centers evolving, improving, moving into a future where maybe your services are not quite as critical as they are today?
And that would be a wonderful place to be.
Yes.
I think that we could one day have a world without child abuse. I think that would be the perfect vision. For now, we are going to continue to work with communities that are interested in having a child advocacy center that may not have one, to ensure that those children have the full array of services as well. So that's very important to the Florida network.
Okay. What are your thoughts, Jackie?
Well, yes, it would be great to have a world without child abuse, most definitely. In reality, I'm just very proud of our organization statewide, and then my individual CAC. We have the opportunity kind of to be like entrepreneurs, to look at, you know, what gaps are missing in our community, what services can we put in place, and how can we affect change, and how can we improve the lives of children in our community. And so, you know, I think that's exciting work and good work, and just really proud of what we do.
The work of the angels, I have heard someone refer to it as.
Well, sometimes they don't act like angels, but, you know.
But that's why we have all these educational resources to kind of get things tamped down a little bit and in a better direction. So, folks, again, for those who are interested in finding out more about the network of child advocacy centers in Florida, now 27 strong from Pensacola all the way down to Monroe County, how can people find out more and how can they get involved and what you guys need to keep on keeping on?
They can visit our website at www.fncac.org, where we have how to report child abuse. We just have a lot of information on the website. We have information about our conference. And as I said, that will hopefully, the conference website will actually be going live by next week. We will have information about our brunch bags and bingo for anyone locally who would like to come out and support the room makeovers we're doing and have just an absolute fun time. We also have information about our Stop Child Abuse license plate. So anyone in the state of Florida can purchase a Stop Child Abuse license plate or make a voluntary donation if you're already supporting another license plate. You can make a voluntary donation as well. And all of that money will go and support the work that the child advocacy centers are doing in Florida.
And as so many nonprofit organizations depend incredibly on volunteer help, non-paid staff, Jackie Stevens, you need a couple additional folks to hang around and help out.
We can always use volunteers and help, you know, whether it's from the volunteer leadership, from our boards of directors to, you know, somebody helping us file files and answer phones. So, yes.
And it's a great cause because you'll be helping kids. And what better cause is there? Folks, I really appreciate your coming on this edition of Perspectives to talk about the Network of Child Advocacy Centers, what you guys do, and good luck with the upcoming conference. We'll be hoping to have you back soon to give us an update on how things are developing, morphing, evolving as we go forward, and thank you for all you do to help out. Board President Jackie Stevens down there in colorful Collier County and the Executive Director of the Network, Cindy Valley. Thank you all for being on Perspectives.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you for having us.
Perspectives produced by WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. Our thanks going out to Taylor Cox, Paul Dam, Amy Diaz de Villegas, Brandon Brown, Trisha Moynihan, and Lydell Rawls, our director of content. Kim Kelling is executive producer of the show, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Well, since 2007, KCCI, the Knight Creative Communities Institute, has been striving to improve the capital city's quality of life through unique partnerships and projects. A lot of that going around nowadays, you notice. We'll talk with KCCI people about what's up next week, and we hope you'll be able to join us for that discussion right here on Perspectives from WFSU Public Media. Take care.
For more information about Perspectives and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org.